Verses 6 through 8, the certainty of salvation and restoration. And then verses 9 through 11, the provider of salvation and restoration. That's the first question. Does God want to save us, or is he done with us? Once you get a yes to the first question, verses 1 through 11, the next question is this: can God save us? That's the question. Can God save us? Remember what's at stake here. Or is our God like all the other nations' gods, who gives them victory and then defeat? Sometimes he appears to be able and sometimes he doesn't. Does God want to save us? And if the answer is yes, here's the question. Here we are, a ravaged people, halfway around the world, so to speak. Can God really deliver us, restore us, save us? If he wants to, can he? Oh, yeah.
They're gone.
Everybody get that point? So here's the southern kingdom sitting in Babylon in exile, and they personally had watched years before as the northern kingdom basically was decimated and disappeared into history under the Assyrians. So, I mean, they've seen what appears to be God wiping his hands of a people. And he did. So does God want to save us, and can God save us? And so for Isaiah's original audience, he's right in chapter 40. Here you are, you're a Babylonian exile, you're slaves, you're defeated, powerless, removed from your home, no hopes, no vestiges, all of it's gone. And what would you say these verses would bring you? Ready? Hope. Encouragement. Would they not? They would bring you great remembrance of who our God is. Here you are, removed. There's no temple, there's no priest, there's no sacrifice system, there's nothing. So does God want to save us? The answer is yes. Can God save us? Can God save us? And what we find beginning in verse 12 through the rest of this chapter, I want to draw your attention to the last few words of verse 9. Okay, everybody look at the last few words of verse 9. Now my Bible, NAS, says what? What does your Bible say? Behold your God, or here is your God. And what I want to suggest to you is beginning in verse 12 to the end of this chapter, that is exactly what Isaiah does. He calls Israel, or Judah rather, to behold their God. In other words, he holds up God. How am I going to answer the question, can God save us? Behold your God. Everybody got the point? And so it's something like this. Basically, verses 12 through 31, what Isaiah is saying is, listen, can God save you? The answer is yes. And you know why? Because there is none like God. There is none like God. And in fact, let me give you a quick outline of verses 12 through 31. Basically, what's being said here is there is none like God in the universe. Verses 12, 14, verses 25 and 26. Secondly, there is none like God in the history of the world. Verses 15 and 17, verses 23 and 24. And thirdly and finally, there is none like God amongst all the gods of the nations. Verses 19 and 20. So, does God want to save us? Verses 1 through 11, yes. Can God save us? Verses 12 through 31, verse 31. Can God save us? It's also a yes. And how is that so? Behold your God. There is none like God amongst all of creation. There is none like God amongst all of human history. There is none like God amongst the nations' false gods. In fact, if you'll see this section, you'll see two key verses that help you really understand the theme of this section. Verse 18, look at it, where Isaiah asks this question: to whom then will you liken God? What's the answer? No one. Or what likeness will you compare to him who is like your God? You'll see it also in verse 25, the same thought. To whom then will you liken me, God says, that I would be like his equal, says the Holy One? It's a rhetorical question. There's nobody. So again, Isaiah 40, verses 1 through 11, will God save us? Yes. Verses 12 through 31, can God save us? Behold your God. There's none like your God. There's no one like your God. Not in creation, not in history, not amongst the false gods of the nations. There's none like your God. So I want to use those 3 points in creation, in history, and amongst the gods to basically look at this chapter. So first of all, Isaiah is telling these exiles, there is none like your God in creation. Notice verses 12 through 14. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? Who has directed the spirit of the Lord or as his counselor has informed him? With whom did he consult and who gave him understanding? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? What's going on in this is Isaiah is comparing God to everything else in creation. And what is he saying? He's saying there's none like God in all of creation. Now, you'll notice that in these verses, 12 through 14, I love these verses, by the way. Isaiah makes a series of rhetorical questions, right? It's rhetoric. And the rhetorical questions are asked in order to demonstrate this idea that there is one God. There is not a pantheon of gods. God is the sole creator of everything. God is above nature, beyond nature. He's above all creation. There's none like God in all of creation. As you again look, and I'd ask you just allow your eyes to set down on the text, verses 12 through 14. You know what you have a picture of here, if you can see it? Allow the words and get the picture. What you really have being described here is you have a picture sort of as God, as this master craftsman creating creation. Sort of the skill of his hands, his precise markings, his exact calculations. He uses balances and scales. Everybody see it? Let me read it again. Who has measured out the waters? Who has marked off the heavens? Who's calculated the dust? Who's weighed the mountains? Who's put the hills in a scale? And who's directed all this? Here's this master craftsman creating. And listen, do we not know as science develops and evolves, my gosh, the complexities of this universe are beyond understanding. Here, and who did this? Who did this? And then verse 14, verse 13 of 14, not only did he do this, but he did this without anybody's help. No counsel, no direction, nobody contributed to the creation of the entire universe. He did it all by what? Himself. What's the point? There is none like your God in all of creation. He created it all by himself. Now, everybody got that picture? Say amen. Okay, you got that picture. God created all by himself. But look across the page in the same chapter and look, for instance, at verses 18 through 20. This is a comparison. Here's the question, verse 18. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare to him? Okay, how about this? How about an idol? What about an idol? A craftsman cast it. A goldsmith plates it with gold. The silversmith fashions its silver chains on it. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot, and he seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not rot. Here's another picture of a craftsman's table, right? Everybody got it? What's the big difference between God as the craftsman and the idolater as a craftsman? Remember, here we have God creating everything, and here we have a man taking what God has created to make something that is crazy. And of course, there's sarcasm in there. For instance, you'll notice in these verses, in verse 20, here we have this guy making this idol out of a tree that doesn't rot. What's the problem with that statement? Eventually it'll what? Or he's creating this idol that will not totter. What's the problem with that statement? Eventually it will totter. So, and by the way, idolatry in the mind of Isaiah is absolutely absurd. And it is absurd, isn't it? And so here you have God by himself creating the universe, and then you have idolatry going on, and you know what? It takes everybody. It takes the guy, and then it takes the craftsman, and it takes the goldsmith, then it takes the silversmith, and even then, we all throw our best effort in, and what do we end up? Something quite remarkably ridiculous. How about the God of history now? Secondly, there is none like our God in creation. There is none like our God in history. Notice verse 15 and 17. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket, and they are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, God, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. Now jump to verse 21. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginnings? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. It is he who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes judges of the earth, what? Meaningless. Not only is there none like God in creation, there is none like God in all of human history. You know, you get it. People say, do you think America's dying, fading away? I don't know. I know this. When God's done with America, America will disappear. That's what will happen. God sits and laughs at the nations. He's not affected by, he controls history. History is his story. He raises them up and he puts them down. And in these verses, I don't know if you noticed this, but did you notice Isaiah's use of smallness? Everything's small to God, isn't it? Verse 15, he talks about drops. He talks about specks of dust. He talks about nations being like grasshoppers. What's the point? The point is everything is like dust, drops, and grasshoppers compared to God. Human history. Now think about this idea, right? These verses that we read in light of Judah's situation. Here they are in exile, and they're in exile because they didn't trust God with their history, right? They're in exile because they didn't see God as big. They saw the Assyrians as big, and the Babylonians as big, and the Egyptians as big. And what is Isaiah saying? Everybody gets the point. This section calls the readers, Isaiah's readers, to reflect back on the foolishness of their own history. And of course, the smallness of those entities is held in this section to the bigness of God. I love verse 16. It's very interesting. I don't know if you noted it when we read. You know, remember, you've heard of the cedars of Lebanon? The cedars of Lebanon was a real deal. The cedars of Lebanon consisted of hundreds and hundreds of miles of forest with massive cedars. I mean, I grew up in northern, you know, we visited, we were talking about that kid in northern. Have you ever seen giant cedars? That's the Lebanese cedars. And you know what's being said compared to the smallness of the nations is the hugeness of God. And in verse 16, Isaiah is saying this, that even all the cedars that fill the vast forests of Lebanon are not enough wood to provide the kind of offering that God deserves. And then on in verse 16, and even all the animals that fill those forests are not enough to provide the sacrifices necessary or appropriate to the kind of offering that our God, our huge God, deserves. One offering can't be found in all the cedars of Lebanon and the animals that inhabit the forest. Okay, also, there is none like God, not only in creation and history, but also there is none like God amongst the gods of the nations. Notice verse 18 and 20 with me again. Whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare to him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it, a silver gold plates with gold, a silversmith fashions silver chains on it. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. Sarcasm again, all rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman. He can't do it by himself to prepare the idol that will not totter. Again, sarcasm, all eventually totter. As I said earlier, there is nothing more ridiculous in the mind of Isaiah than the idea of idolatry. And I want to show you some verses, because here we see it. You know, you see this? Here you guys do this. You're supposed to be like, and you do this. You take this piece of wood here, and that happens to it, and then you take it over here, and this happens to it, and then you take it over here, and this happens to it, and then you take it over here, and this happens, and then you take it home, and you set it there, and you bow down and worship to it. It's ridiculous. Look at chapter 41 for a minute, verse 6 and 7. Notice, each one helps his neighbor. And by the way, here they are making the household idol. That's what's taking place in this. And they're saying to his brother, "Be strong." So the craftsman encourages the smelter, and he who smooths metal with a hammer encourages he who beats on the anvil, saying of the smoldering, "It's good." And he fastens it with nails so that it will not totter. Do you get what's being said here? As this thing goes from station to station to station, as it gets past a station to station, Isaiah is saying, you know what? Each person has to encourage the next. You know why? Because each person in that line of craftsmen, in order to end up, realizes the absolute futility of what they're doing. I mean, another one. And so this guy has to encourage this guy when he passes it off, only to go get another one. This guy has to encourage this guy as he passes it off. This is the futility of this. One of my favorite, look at chapter 44. This is great stuff. Verse 9, chapter 44, verse 9. Those who fashion a graven image are all of them, what? Futile. And their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witness fail to see or know, so that they will be put to shame. Who has fashioned a god or cast an idol to no profit? That's a rhetorical question. Everyone. Behold, all his companions we will put to shame, for the craftsmen themselves are mere men. Let them all assemble themselves. Let them stand up. Let them tremble, and let them together be put to shame. Verse 12, the man shapes iron into a cutting tool and does his work over coals, fashioning it with a hammer and doing it with strong arm. He also gets hungry, and his strength fails, and he drinks no water, becomes weary. In other words, and then another shapes wood. He extends a measuring line. He outlines it with red chalk. He works it, plates it, outlines it with a compass, makes it like the form of a man, like the beauty of a man, so that it may sit in his house. Surely he cuts cedars for himself and takes a cypress and an oak and raises it up for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a fir, and the rain makes it grow. Then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself. That's, he uses it for firewood. But he also makes a fire to break the bread. He feeds himself. But he also makes a god and worships it. Everybody got the point? Goes out, gets a tree, cuts it into three parts. You know, warms self a part of it, cooks with the other part of it, and then carves up and worships the third part of it. It's ludicrous. He makes a graven image. Look at this, verse 15. Makes a graven image, falls down before it. Half of it he burns with the fire. Over this half he eats meat, and he roasts his roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself with it. Ah, I'm warm. I've seen fire. But the rest of it, he makes it to a god. His graven image, and he falls down before it, worships it, also prays to it, says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." Do you see how ridiculous this is? They do not know, nor do they understand, for he has smeared over their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot comprehend. No one recalls, nor is there any knowledge or understanding to say, "I have burned half of it with a fire and also baked bread over its coals. I roast meat on it and eat it. Then I make the rest of it into an abomination, fall down before a block of wood." He feeds on ashes, deceives his heart, is turned away. And everybody gets the picture. You can go back to Isaiah 40. And so here are the gods of the world. Here are the gods of the world. And you know what? Any form of idolatry is as absurd as what Isaiah is discussing. To idolize men, money. I mean, do we not know it's all passing? Futility. What do you think the whole point of Ecclesiastes is? Vanity of vanities, all is what? Huh? I really believe that God gave us Solomon for a reason. Because most people, I think, live in the delusion that if I only had this, I would feel fulfilled. And of course, it's always just beyond that which you have, right? We're all different in every area, economically, knowledge, education, we're all different. Health, beauty, whatever, vanity, whatever. But everybody wants just a little more. Would you agree with that? Everybody wants just a little. You know what? For Solomon, there was none more. There was none more. He had everything. He had everything. Solomon would have been all the billionaires of our world crammed together in that part of the world. He had everything. Wives? Hundreds of them. Hundreds of them. I've been to Jerusalem, and with God, you know, they go, well, these were his copper mines, and then you go somewhere, these were his silver mines, these were his gold mines. You see this vast, these were his stables. These were his vineyards. I mean, it just goes on and on. And you know what? Who writes Ecclesiastes? In fact, without the delusion, what you really become, I believe, compelled by is the absolute shallowness. He says basically, I don't know, it's sort of like Shakespeare, to live or to die. Life is so meaningless and purposeless that I just want to give it up. And so that's the idea of idolatry. Whether it's a wood idol or it's the things of this world, it is all futile and vanity. And that's the point that's being made here. The final question is asked in the remaining part of this thing, part of this chapter. And it goes something like this. Will God save us? What's the answer? Can God save us? What's the answer? Now, the next question I heard asked when I asked for the first question, and what would the next one be? When will God save us? And so notice with me, if you would, beginning in verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God? What is he saying? God knows our sin. Do you believe that? Do you not know, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. So when they ask the question, when, what God says on the front end is this: you're there for a reason. Will I save you? Yes. Can I save you? Yes. When? You're there in your predicament for a reason. And what is the reason? You have sinned against me. And I am perfectly familiar with all of it. Yeah? You know, we have this notion sometimes that God's just like an instant deliverer. He can make all the consequences go away. Does it work that way? What did Jesus say? That which a man sows shall he. I mean, you can be forgiven and still be in the middle of consequences. They're in consequences. And verse 29, he gives strength to the weary. In other words, listen, though you will go through this judgment and discipline, God will provide. He will give strength to you who are in this judgment, the weary. And to him who lacks might, he increases power. You know, God is disciplining you, and he will provide what you need to make it through this period. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous men stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. And what's the point? In the midst of this judgment, remember the question's when, you're there because you sinned against me. You're there because you need to be there. I've determined for you to be there. But you know what's going to happen while you're there? You're going to turn to me. You're going to turn to me like you should have turned to me. And also, and they will mount up, here's the promise of deliverance, and they will mount up with wings like eagles, and they will run and not get tired. They will walk and not grow weary. And the idea is that to the answer when, your situation that you're in is because you have sinned against me, you still need to learn. Two, I have a plan, and when is part of my plan, but you're not smart enough, wise enough, spiritual enough to understand my plan. I get that answer a lot from God. I'd tell you, but you wouldn't understand. You know what I mean? That's my sense at times. You wouldn't understand. And then three, but when I do come to save you, you will find that I provide everything you need for your salvation. You will be provided for. And that's the answer. Any questions or thoughts? What's the form, Don's up there, what's the form, there's a saying for that, less than nothing, that's an impossibility, nothing is nothing, can't be less than nothing, what do they call that, you know, it's a certain, it start, is it a sin, I can't remember, it's a certain kind of phrase, but you get the point, you know, less, we say that all the time, less than nothing is an impossibility, because nothing is nothing, and so, that's a dig. The bigness of God and the small, that's a dig. You're not just nothing. You're less than nothing. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Our country is godless. I mean, even in this whole political cycle, nobody's, you know, all I hear is just more secular, but, you know, I'm not just, and I just believe as long as we continue down this road, I don't care who, what party, and I'm just being a herald, guys. I mean, I'm not apolitical or any of that. I just believe as long as our country continues in godlessness, and God is not the answer, not the solution, no one's seeking to serve him, know him, declare him, follow him, or obey him, it doesn't matter who you put in office. And we see it, even Hezekiah, you know, we see bad kings through life, through Isaiah chapter 1 through 40. What have we seen? We've seen some kings better than others. Some of them are abominations. Some of them are better. But you know what? They're gone. Despite all of that, they're in judgment. And it happened. Mary said it's going to be like this. It's going to be like a wall with a bulge in it. You think it's standing and it's just going to collapse. So how that all looks for us, I don't know, but I think you get my point. And as Christians, you know, my deal is not, you know, as Christians, the real call for Isaiah to us is what? We need to be looking to God, calling on, praying to God for all the things that concern us, nationally, internationally, geopolitically, ourselves, our nation, our friends, so forth and so on. So that's my sense. Anybody else? Okay. I see a hand. Let's pray together.